that's what it's easy to forget, that what things were like 40 years ago, and when the waters really were polluted throughout the United States, the air was very dirty. And then it was really with these first early laws, NEPA, that allowed citizens to sue and citizens to participate in protecting the environment. And that was when NRDC got started. It paralleled a lot of other movements in the United States at that time. If you remember, it was an exciting time with the civil rights movement, women's movement was starting, the peace movement. And it was a time when people felt they could change the world. And there was that spirit with NRDC in 1970 when it started. And as it turned out, in many ways, we, the collective, have changed the world. And I think in many ways for the better, even though we still have a lot of work to do.
When you look back with a historical band and you look at Cuyahoga and you look at Santa Barbara oil spill, it's easy to say, well, of course, movements coalesced and came together, but it wasn't that easy at first, was it?
It certainly wasn't that easy. It wasn't a slam dunk at all. But there was also personal reasons for John and I, because you could just see what was happening to our own family. We were living in Manhattan, and as we say in the book, if one of our children slept near an open window, there would be ash on their forehead because garbage was simply burned in the basements of apartment buildings, and the river ran dirty as well. And there was one thing that helped bring this all together, though, and that was the fight in the Hudson Highlands to save Storm King Mountain, a famous, beautiful mountain that was painted by the Hudson River painters. And Con Edison had proposed a pump storage plant there, which would have really defaced the mountain, put in power lines, and it would have been quite destructive and killed a lot of fish. There was a small group of actually attorneys in their 50s and their wives who formed an organization to try to stop Con Ed. And what they learned is they thought it was very expensive to come up against a large corporation. And they had this really beneficent view that most people in the world could never have afforded to do that. So they wanted to start an organization, a public interest law firm that would represent the public and, in a way, represent environment. And they hired John, and this is slightly apocryphal. They said, we'll hire you for about $25,000 a year. Your first job is to go find that money, you know, for your salary. And we had three young children, so they sent John to Ford Foundation. And Ford had a group of young lawyers. They were young, they were somewhat ribald and tricky, and they were a little nervous to fund this group of 25-year-olds who were graduates of Yale Law School and had a lot of energy and ideas about what they wanted to do. But they said to John and they said to the Yale group, if you all can come together and form an organization, we will give you initial funding. And it started small in that way. There were maybe 9 or 10 people involved and a very small board. But one of the themes of the book and the way we still think is you may start small, but always think big.
You know, so at the beginning, 1969, early 70s, there are obvious environmental problems, things that are easy to show in pictures or slides. As you move into the 70s and 80s and start being concerned with pesticides, that became trickier because you couldn't see pesticides. That was something that happened before the food or whatever got to our table or our grocery store.
Right. One of the things, again, starting small and thinking big, one thing I'll just say as an overview, with the Environmental Protection Agency listing things that are in our foods and chemicals and those kinds of things are not really toxic until they're proved toxic. So it's a kind of a reverse of what it should be that NRDC scientists are always fighting. Don't wait until you prove something's bad and then go back and take it off the market, but let's check things beforehand. It's a very complicated process. But one of the things NRDC did about this started out with simply Laurie Mott and Al Meyerhoff and here in the San Francisco office going to the supermarket and buying groceries. So they bought a market basket full of groceries, and they had them tested. And they found there were incredible numbers of pesticides, including DDT, on the fruit and vegetables that had been, you know, outlawed for years in the United States. And with this small start, again, they began to examine and bring lawsuits against companies that were putting pesticides and other kinds of toxic elements on apples. And it led to the famous and infamous in some ways Alar case that still NRDC has been proved right in the long run, and that was that the amount of Alar, which was a chemical that was also used in World War II bombing was in exorbitant proportions to children. A toddler drinks a lot more apple juice, therefore eats a lot more apples even than an adult. And the toxic testing was done on a 160-pound adult. But what about this little kid walking around drinking apple juice? And it also shows that personal interest is always important in NRDC, because the women that worked on this case had young children and were very concerned about toxics in the environment and for their children. And it really helped found the whole organic movement that's very big in the United States now and is great, and sustainable development, all those things that tie together.
I'm talking with Patricia Adams. She is the co-author of A Force for Nature, the story of NRDC and the fight to save our planet. We could talk for hours about some of the very familiar and headline-grabbing topics that are in the book, like the Exxon Valdez and the creation of the LEED green building standards. But I want to ask you about a couple of, I think, perhaps not well-known episodes that just I found very fascinating when I was reading about the book. One was about the organization when James Watt, who was Secretary of Interior, was proposing 1 billion acres to be made ready for offshore drilling. 1 billion acres. And the way things came together to reduce the amount of land, offshore land, that would be available for drilling. It was you, it was the NRDC, Robert Redford, and some other people that came together. And it was quite an interesting strategy that developed. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Are you talking about the meeting in Morro Bay?
Yes.
With Robert Redford?
Yes.
And the Institute for Resource Management. I just want to say that Robert Redford, we all, of course, know of him as a great actor and founder of Sundance, but he's also been committed to environmental issues since very early on. And he was a man before his time when he formed this Institute for Resource Management, which brought together people from the corporate world, also Native Americans, and environmentalists. Oh, let's come to the table and see if we can work something out. It was an idea before its time in many ways. The meeting you're referring to was in Morro Bay in California. And they got together with basically the oil companies about drilling on the in the sea up in Alaska in the Bering Sea. And what they did was they simply had this map, and we still have it in the offices at New York, a sort of a map of the Bering Sea. And they said, okay, let's agree. If you want to drill in certain places, we environmentalists will not bring lawsuits against you. But these are places we absolutely want to protect. And if you drill here, then we will see you in court. And then there are these negotiable areas sort of in the middle. So they negotiated this. And as they were talking, one of the executives looked at it and said, you mean you really will leave us alone? If we leave you alone there and you won't bring a lawsuit? And John said, yes, we guarantee. And it was a kind of an agreement that, I mean, things changed and went on. They brought this agreement to Washington, and I think it was Hodel was the, he had taken Watt's place. And even though at the time he kind of, as the Secretary of the Interior, said, well, that's our job, that's not your job. But in the end, they sort of followed this pattern. So again, there's subtle ways and obvious ways that things change. And you're right, to bring this up, it's a little-known issue or a little-known case for NRDC, but it was very important at the time.
And then there is the topic of acoustic smog, sounds in the oceans, and how that can hurt marine animals.
Joel Reynolds in the Los Angeles office, actually, he comes from a family of musicians. This sound is a part of his life. And he read somewhere that they were testing the water temperature by using sonar sound, which seems benign in a way, but it led him to see, okay, now what are these sonar ripples doing to the marine mammals there? And studies found that they do horrible things. They make their eardrums burst. They push them to the surface. And they found, you know, any area where the Navy or anybody is testing with sonar, you have beached whales, and you can just parallel it and see what's happening. So Joel brought this lawsuit against actually the U.S. Navy, and that's pretty brave to do that. And because it is, as you refer to, acoustic smog, just what it's doing to the marine mammals in our ocean, and travel sounds for miles, thousands of miles. And also that's the way animals get their food. That's the way they communicate. So it's extraordinarily destructive. Now, this lawsuit's gone all the way to the Supreme Court. And some of it was dismissed, but again, some of these things are incremental, and this issue is now on the table and is now in public, and I think we'll continue to make progress on that issue of sonar testing.
And what was so interesting is the trite way to explain many environmental controversies or lawsuits is to say it's these people against corporations. This was initiated by scientists. These were people who were trying to figure out, you know, the health of the ocean.
That's true. And not only with scientists, but I have to leap forward a little bit and say many corporations and businesses today do believe that green is good, not because for moral issues, but because it's good business. So we're finding more cooperation. I think the biggest issue, though, that we do have to refer to is the climate change and the fact that humanity is dependent right now on fossil fuels. And we're going to the ends of the earth to get these fossil fuels. I mean, you just look at the Gulf, how deep they have to drill now for oil. The tar sands up in Canada, we're really abusing the earth to get fossil fuels. And our real hope in the future is to find alternatives to these fossil fuels. And money does support oil and gas and coal industries and the railroads. So that is a big issue, too, to work towards not only corporation but new technology.
Are you optimistic? Because we are in such, and have been for some time, but it's a sort of soundbite culture and a name-calling, finger-pointing sort of public discussion over important issues. Are you optimistic that there can be meaningful, widespread public discussions about these topics?
I don't know about how many public discussions. You know, climate change is sort of vague for a lot of people. It's not right in front of them. But doing this book tour and talking to people, sometimes I'm standing in a room with people and I look at them, and number one, I realize they weren't even born in 1970, right? They're under 30, many of them. But then at the same time, they pull out their iPhone, and I think, you know what? These young people understand technology in general, but also specifically in a way, literally within their hands may be the way to change the future. And I think that getting fossil fuels, if you just argue economically, is going to get so expensive that there will be alternative waves. And I hope there's a better education and that our book participates in that education about the dangers we're involved with and how important it is to find alternatives and things like efficiency. But on the other hand, it's not just gloom and doom. People just walk away from gloom and doom and kind of shake their head and say, well, what can I do? Well, a lot can be done, and we're hoping this book is more positive in that sense.
Is there a sense that when you're on this book tour and when you're talking to people, it's the choir you're preaching to, and you hope that they then spread the message?
Well, in all honesty, it is sometimes the choir. And what we're hoping is that the book, I mean, Kyle, I'm sure people listening to you, this may be new to them, this book and these ideas. So we're hoping that through some of these interviews that people who normally might not even hear about the book will and be interested in reading it. And it is a good read because it's stories of the people who tried to bring these changes. So we're hoping that the book will break out a little bit beyond the already committed environmentalists, as you say. But anyway, at least we have a choir.
And Patricia Adams, thank you so much for your time.
Well, thank you, Kyle. It was great to talk with you.